You're listening to a State Library of Victoria recording. For more information, go to slv.vic.gov.au.
Mark comes a little bit closer from home, although he hails from Massachusetts. He's now based in Sydney. He's been working in the IT domain since the early 1980s and is co-inventor of VRML, Virtual Reality Modelling Language. This invention in the 1990s springboarded him into a career as a writer, teacher and consultant. He's the author of numerous books, including The Human Network, Sharing Knowledge and Power in the 21st Century. He's also a prolific contributor of articles to anthologies, magazines and newspapers, and is currently an honorary lecturer at the University of Sydney. However, many of you will be most familiar with him as a judge on the ABC program, The New Inventors. Mark will be talking today on the conversation that's happening all around you and why you need to be involved in it.
Good afternoon, everybody. So first off, I have a message for you, and that message is to relax and forgive yourselves, because we're sort of sticking you headfirst into a brand new world today. And it is brand new, and we forget that it's brand new. So when I arrived in Australia 6 years ago, the Outre form of communication was electronic mail. Now, I'm going to do a little survey, or a couple of surveys here. How many of you do not own or regularly use a mobile phone? Okay, so one person. All right, then now that's about right for Australia. How many of you have accounts on Facebook? Whoa. All right, so that's, and then, you know, there's 7 million, 8 million Facebook users out of 22 million Australians, and obviously overrepresented in this room. How many of you use Twitter regularly? Okay, again, so it's smaller, but still substantial. Now, again, 6 years ago, sending an email was pretty much how it was. Now, in the 6 years, and I don't know if it has something to do with me moving to Australia, because goodness knows, but in the 6 years since I've been here, what's happened is communication as a medium has basically fundamentally exploded. It's exploded, and it's exploded across several different domains. And what I want to do first off is take a look at each of these domains, because they're illuminating really the changes that are underfoot. So first off, there are more ways to connect to other people than there have ever been before. So basically, if anyone is in reach of a radio wave these days, they are potentially contactable. There's 4.5 billion people on planet Earth who now have a mobile phone, now have a mobile phone number. And, of course, there are something like 1.2 billion people who are connected to the wired internet, as we think of it. And every one of us, how many of you, by the way, let me take a third, another survey. How many of you have more than one email address? So almost everyone in here has more than one. So you have multiple ways of being contacted, even over email. So we have this enormous level of connectivity. I can send you a message on Facebook. I can send you a message via SMS. I can send you a message via email. I can call you, so on and so on and so forth. All these different methods are now creating more points in and more points out than ever before. Now, second, there's also more ways to share with one another than ever before. When I got to Australia, there was no YouTube. YouTube had not been invented yet. There was no Flickr. There was no Delicious. There was barely a Blogger, and people were kind of starting to blog, but it hadn't become a really, really big thing yet. And what this means is that there's more media being targeted more pervasively and more promiscuously than ever before. So it's possible for me to send a message out, to create a video, and then pass it along to a few of my friends, who will then pass it along to a few of their friends, and pretty soon you've got half the nation talking about something. And we all know about that. We call that viral media. But the social sharing has become an intrinsic feature in our culture, so much so that we don't even think about it anymore. Third off, you have people sharing, you have people connected, you also have people who are now practicing very specific forms of sharing, knowledge sharing. And of course, the best example that we always think of with this is Wikipedia, which is what happens when people decide that they're going to get together and share facts. You get enough people sharing facts, and all of a sudden you have an encyclopedia that has 3 million entries. Now, how many of you have heard of WikiLeaks? So there's a few people who have heard of WikiLeaks. Let me explain for the rest of you what WikiLeaks is. WikiLeaks is a website that allows anyone to anonymously dump any document that they like onto the site, and it's then shared by everyone else. Now, last year, someone took the ACMA blacklist of banned websites. No one really knows where it came from. And it went up on WikiLeaks. And then all of the rest of us could find out the sites that were banned by ACMA, including the site of a dentist in Queensland, which was actually very interesting and probably very wrong, and all sorts of other websites. And, of course, there were naughty websites on there because you'd expect that. It's the ACMA blacklist. But what you found out, what was the most interesting thing about that, were the sites that weren't naughty, that ACMA was banning. But as much as ACMA may have wanted to keep the list secret, it wasn't enough that the list is a list of banned sites, but the list itself is actually a banned item. It was impossible to keep that banned because all you needed to do was to get one person with one copy of the list. They could post it to WikiLeaks, and then that knowledge is shared everywhere. Another site, ratemyprofessors.com, allows students to rate their instructors, their lecturers, their professors, so that students who are about to take classes, perhaps with those lecturers, should know whether these lecturers grade easy, whether they're bad lecturers, whether they give really interesting lectures. And this has become such a problem for universities that universities can no longer give students bad lecturers who happen to be good researchers. So it's basically changed the tenor of the university. It's changed the power flow in the university because students are now sharing information amongst themselves, and that shared information has given them a power they never had before. Think about the league tables that we're all so afraid of when it comes to the school system. That's exactly what's going to start happening now. It doesn't matter whether it happens in the newspapers, because the kids and the parents will start to share that information. Now, fourth and finally, people can translate shared knowledge into increased effectiveness in their actions. And you see, getup.org.au is a great example of this. So it's a highly networked political organization. They poll their members to figure out what issues they want to follow. They develop a platform around those issues. They consult with their membership around that. And then they consult with that membership in terms of putting the platform into place. And for a very small organization, GetUp has had a very strong impact in politics throughout Australia. Another organization, which you probably haven't heard of, or maybe hadn't heard of, is called Anonymous. You hadn't heard about it until they hacked the Prime Minister's website a couple of months ago. And again, Anonymous is an entirely networked organization that pools its resources and pools its knowledge so that it can pool its activities. So you have now hyperconnectivity, sharing, shared knowledge leading to power. And with all of those steps, one after another, what we have now is a situation where the pressure is on. Because to perform in the 21st century, to perform effectively in the 21st century, social media has become the new foundation. There's no ignoring it, and there's no hoping that it's going to go away because it's not a fad. It's not as though the specific forms of it may come and go. It may not be Facebook next year. It may not be Twitter next year. But the idea of connecting and using those connections to share and to share knowledge and share power, that's here to stay. And it's doing for us what the steam engine did for our great-great-grandparents 200 years ago. It's basically amplifying our powers. So the same way that the steam engine amplified muscle power, social networks are amplifying our creative and connective capabilities. And it's changing the landscape completely. But of course, the thing that we all have to recognize is that it's a beast. And there's no other way to put it. We're playing with fire here. Working with social media is a dangerous proposition. And the danger of social media breaks down into two orthogonal dimensions. In one side, you have to look at the outside, which is fighting to get in. And the other side, you have to look at the inside, which is fighting to break out. So let's take a look at the outside coming in. Here, what we see is that there's a conversation that's going on. The conversation is about you. It's about your department. It's about your program. It's about your employees. It concerns you. This is a conversation that has been about you, it concerns you, and you could benefit from it if you knew where the conversation was going on. But do you know where that conversation is happening? In fact, the conversation is probably happening everywhere. It's happening all of the time. And why is that conversation happening? That conversation is happening because it is relevant to you. Someone has a problem, or they have a question, or they have a suggestion, or whatever it might be. And they're sharing that question or problem or suggestion through the nearest available channel. Now, that channel for them might be Facebook. That channel for them might be Twitter. That channel for them might be a blog. You don't know. It's going to vary from person to person and whatever their tastes are and however they happen to be connected at the time they have that problem or question or issue. And the question for you then is, are you there? Are you there to be able to listen to it? Now, when you leave the seminar today, you'll know. You'll no longer have ignorance as an excuse. You'll know that you have to be listening to these channels. But why should you care? Why should you listen to these channels? Well, because the channels are relevant. And in the worst case, you need to listen to these channels all the time to prevent something that I call the nuclear option. Now, let me explain what the nuclear option is. A very good friend lives in the United States, Gregory. Gregory joined Twitter last year. And around the time that he joined Twitter, he went off to a meeting. He's a consultant. He was working with a small company in New Mexico, helping to guide them into Web 2.0. Now, as a consultant, and I know this because I'm a consultant as well, you get hired very often so that you can bring a message to the higher-ups in the company or the organization that the mid-range managers are too afraid to deliver themselves. And of course, this is what Gregory did. He had his nice dog and pony show talking about all the great stuff that goes on with Web 2.0 and why it's really important and why it's really relevant. And then the CEO of the company, who was the main target of the meeting, proceeded to savage him, proceeded to rip him apart, proceeded to make him feel like he was the lowest scum of the earth for bringing these new ideas in. And he left the meeting, decompressed a little bit, and decided that he was going to post to Twitter how he was feeling. Now, he only had about 20 friends on Twitter. And so I happened to read this message about how horrible he's feeling, what a bad time he's feeling. And what Gregory hadn't reckoned on was that although he had only about 20 friends on Twitter, two of his friends, myself and a fellow named Raven, had about 2,000 followers on Twitter. And all we had to do was pass that message along. And if he'd mentioned the CEO by name, if he'd mentioned the company by name, just between Raven and I, because we're both very well connected in technology communities, which is where this woman was attempting to do work as a CEO, we could have effectively destroyed the reputation of that company because we're so effectively well connected. All we have to do is make a statement and make it strong enough, and it will stick. Now, last year, I had my own nuclear moment in Melbourne. Last May, I was speaking at a conference, and I was put up by the conference company at the Stanford Plaza Hotel, which is down the street here. It was the worst hotel experience I've had in 10 years. I'm not making that up, all right? It was the worst, capital T, capital W. And what did I do? I went on Twitter and I told everyone I knew, which was about that point 2,500 people, to never, ever stay at the Stanford Plaza. Now, do I know if they got a tick off in business? I don't know. All I know is that no one from the Stanford Plaza actually contacted me to ask what was wrong. I know that no one from the speaking company, from the events organizing company, contacted me to ask what was wrong. So in other words, there was no one listening to the conversation that was going on. The only way for you to be able to thwart those nuclear moments is if you can nip them in the bud by being receptive and engaged, and hopefully a little bit proactive. You're always going to have people who are going to be dissatisfied or angry or upset or cranky You're always going to have those people. But now they have the capability of being able to reach tens of thousands of people in a moment. That's the amplifier effect of social media. That goes hand in hand. And it doesn't matter whether any of you have anything to do with social media. Oh, except we have this dichotomy here, because all of you are deeply involved in social media because you all have Facebook accounts. You're not using them at work, but you're using them at home. So half of you understands this incredible connectivity and this incredible connection, but when you come into work, you sort of put that all behind you, except you need to now bring that knowledge into the office. You need to now understand that every person you're dealing with everywhere is that well connected, has that much power, and can ruin your day if you're not careful. Now, how do you manage that in the organization? How do you manage it to prevent these nuclear moments, or at least to nip them in the bud? What I've seen working with organizations, both governmental and commercial organizations, is that the first instinct is to take social media and basically attach it to a single point in the organization. Oh, well, that belongs in the media office. Of course. We'll just give it to the media office, and the media office is going to be able to handle Facebook and Twitter and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, when you do that, if you choose to do that, what you're going to find is that single point of connection is going to short out immediately because there's too much there. There's too much going on. There's too much coming in from too many different directions. So something is inevitably going to get dropped, or you're basically just going to short these poor people out. And something's going to go nuclear eventually because it got ignored. That's guaranteed. So, how can you make this work? How can you actually deal with the pressure that's being created by social media? Well, the key here is to spread the communication burden throughout the organization. What you need to do is you need to empower the organization to monitor and respond appropriately. Now, this is the point where you all start breaking out in a cold sweat, because this is uncontrollable. What do you mean, empower my organization? What do you want me to do? Well, okay. It requires a bit of trust. It requires a healthy dose of training. And it does require that dose of training no matter what problem you're going to approach, no matter how you're trying to solve the problem, because if you don't approach that problem that way, you're going to end up with this. Let me tell you another little story. There's a man named Leslie Nasser, lives in Adelaide. And he decided after Twitter got started up, he was going to adopt the persona of fake Stephen Conroy. And actually, no one knew it was Leslie Nasser at the time. It was just fake Stephen Conroy. And fake Stephen Conroy is a rude bastard. He says the most horrible things. He's insulting to you. He's insulting to your cat. He's insulting to your country. It doesn't matter. He's just insulting. And he would say the most horrible things. And eventually, fake Stephen Conroy was unmasked as Leslie Nasser. But that there it could have ended. You know, he's just a mean person. Well, Leslie Nasser has a job. Leslie Nasser's job is he was one of the heads of research at Telstra. Now, let's see. Telstra, Stephen Conroy, is there a correlation? Oh, why, yes, there is. So Telstra finds out about this, drags Leslie Nasser into a meeting, and fires his ass. And then Telstra realizes that they don't have a policy for social media. And so that really, they don't have grounds for firing Leslie Nasser. And so they hire him back. No, seriously, that's exactly what happened. And so the lesson there is that you have to develop a policy before you empower your employees. Now, by a policy, I do not mean that you ban social media, which is right now the blanket policy in a lot of organizations. Oh yeah, we're not letting the employees use Facebook. Of course not. It's just bad. Now, let me point out that your employees are all walking in with these. So banning Facebook actually doesn't mean crap, because it's coming in through too many different dimensions. And social media is only going to get more and more agile at coming into your organizations. So banning is not possible. There's too many ways in. But let's take a look at the most rational approach, the most rational policy I've seen so far, which was developed and unveiled by the EBC last week. And it comes down to 4 points. First, do not mix the professional and the personal in ways that are likely to bring the ABC into disrepute. Okay. Any argument there? No, that seems pretty reasonable. Second, do not undermine your effectiveness at work. And of course, this was the original reason for banning social media. Oh, everyone's going to play with Facebook all day. Well, no. Everyone's a grown-up. They know they have work to do. They're not going to undermine their effectiveness at work. Do not imply ABC endorsement of your personal views. Very reasonable. And finally, do not disclose confidential information obtained at work. Now, the ABC is a good example because the ABC is something that sits between a public organization and a private organization. So they have some of the same some of the strictures as you do as public servants. They're also kind of a commercial organization, kinda. And they're also a media organization. So they have all of these different strictures on them. And if they've been able to distill the entire thorny problem, the Pandora's box of social media, down to these 4 very, very simple guidelines, what I want you to do, I want you folks to carry those 4 out as if they were the 10 commandments. I want you to bear them to your organization. Bring them to your organization, and I want you to insinuate them at a very deep level in your organization before you empower your organization with social media. Because if you do that, then when you go to this empowered organization and say, all right, employees, it is up to all of us to monitor social media. Because this is the other side of the coin. It's not just the outside coming in, it's the inside coming out. The employees within your organizations, the people within your organizations want to reach out. They want to connect. This is the era of connection. And so if you empower them with these rules, when they connect, they will do so sensibly. They will not embarrass your organization. They will know when it is appropriate to address something and when it is appropriate to bounce something upstairs to someone who can address it. They will know when to alert you when a nuclear event is about to happen. And that's what you need, because there's no way that anyone can do it on our own. We need to do it together. As an organization, you need to do it together. Now, is it dangerous? Well, not really. Not when it compared to the alternatives, not when you compare it to the danger of a nuclear option, and not when you compare it to the situation of an employee going rogue because they didn't learn the rules. In fact, it's probably the safest course that you can chart. Thank you.
Now you get both of us. Hey, we can have a microphone each.
Stereo. Questions?
Or have we beaten them into submission? Or are they all too busy twittering?
Wave. So there's something called Google Wave that is just starting to be released now. It's in a very limited beta. It is essentially, the nice thing about it is, if you think of instant messaging systems, this is a persistent one, so it's a conversation you can sort of have, but you can have a number of people involved in it. You can go away, and you can come back, and the conversation's still there. You can pick it up where you left off. You can see what other people have said.
You can even replay the conversation from the point you left to see how it developed,
And
you can add documents and images. And those of us who are playing with it are not quite sure what we're going to do with it, but we all know it matters.
Well, yeah, and it's 100% Australian. It's been designed by Google Sydney, so that's the next thing.
So you get to take over the world.
One of our issues is that some of the other people in government we communicate with their organisations block Facebook, etc. So I know I've sort of said, let's do this, let's do that, but the response back from people not within my organisation is, but we can't access it. What are some ways we could get around that?
Well, many autocratic regimes have ways of using proxy servers to get around these restrictions. So you could learn a lot from the Falun Gong and other organisations in China, but that may not actually be what you were getting at there.
I don't think we want to install Tor servers on their machines.
Generally, any organization has multiple ways, or any individual within an organization has multiple ways in. That's the whole thing about hyperconnectivity. So I guess the thing is that you have to style your approach to match the connectivity of the organization you're trying to work with. At, you know, some level, you may not get better than email, but quite often you'll get websites, you know, that may not be Facebook, but that may have some level of functionality. I mean, that it, you're right, it's a hard nut to crack. I think one of the points that you need to be working on gently is to sort of lure them in by showing what they gain by releasing the block. And that, because that's the thing that's going to get them to release the block. It's not going to be that their fare level has dropped. It's going to be that it's so seductive, it's so alluring.
And the other side of it is that, I mean, there's a lot of work going on at the moment about online identity and federated identity mechanisms and tools like Facebook Connect or MySpace's OpenID, which allow you to integrate services based around identifying yourself to one and then having a presence on the other. And then there are also tools, widgets, which you can put up on a website which pull from a social network site but display the content. So there may be ways to integrate the use of a social networks tool like Facebook at your side with what someone's doing that is not Facebook itself, but to make your data or your updates available to them without asking them to go, you know, all the way to endorsing that particular tool. So you know, in a sense, you can break down the problem slightly, as Mark was saying, and get some functionality which you can then use as an avenue to encouraging greater engagement.
This is actually a question posed on Twitter, so I'm going to ask it on behalf of the person who posed it. But I guess, what are your observations on with government and public servants becoming more open in embracing social media technologies? It assumes that the public servants are responsible to the public. What is the opposite thing is that public servants are actually responsible to government, and that it's government's role to be having the conversation with the public.
I mean, there's a balance there. I think the public servants need to be able to create a space for them to be able to work, but they also need to recognize the fact that the public has an expectation of what their role is with respect to them. Now, sometimes you have to remind the public, look, we're working for the minister, we're not specifically working for you. But if you say that, you always have to follow that up with, but here's the place that you can go. All right. If you don't do that, then you're going to get a nuclear event. That's the thing. But I mean, at the same time, I think that for us to design a public service that doesn't present any open surfaces to the public is a relic of an earlier form of democracy.
Yeah, and it now becomes part of the job you do, is to at least understand where those openings are and be willing to engage. So yeah, you can argue that, you know, you didn't ask for this to happen. The world is changing around you, and it will impose changes on people, and they might not be willing to take them on, but it's going to be very hard to resist.
Bob, I'm interested in the case of Twitter being used to destroy government's attempts at secrecy. Was it the British case where the Guardian was suppressed by, was it the Carter Ruck firm?
Trafficura.
From printing MPs' questions, but Twitter just broke it open. I'm interested in your comment on that.
The precise detail of that is quite important, which is that some judges in the UK have been willing to issue what are called super injunctions, which is an injunction forbidding a newspaper from reporting something, but also forbidding them from reporting the fact they've been forbidden to report it. And a firm called Carter Ruck persuaded a High Court judge to issue such an injunction against the Guardian newspaper around a case involving Trafigura, an oil company that had been dumping toxic waste in Africa, had commissioned a report about the impact on people. They didn't like the report, they were trying to suppress it. So it wasn't actually the government that did this, but it was a consequence of the current law. And the editor of the Guardian, Alan Rusbridger, noted that there was a parliamentary question being asked because under UK law you have parliamentary privilege, you can ask what you want in Parliament, and he had been advised by Carter Ruck that to publish something about the question would be a breach of the injunction because it was a super injunction. And Rushbridger was stuck, so he tweeted about the fact there was a super injunction, not naming it, that related to PMQs. And with about 15 minutes, people had scanned through and figured out which one it was likely to be. And all the other newspapers couldn't do anything because you're bound by the injunction if you even know that it exists, but bloggers didn't know the injunction existed and so could start just posting it. And so, and I was one of them, we all started retweeting the fact that it was about Trafigura, and within a day the whole thing fell apart. It was a really good example of power, but a very specialist example, a very unusual circumstance in which a particular social network could happen at a particular time, therefore not a model for rebuilding democracy, I would argue.
Well, no, but a model for showing that transparency is going to happen by hook or by crook.
That's true, yes. Yeah, you can either clean your own windows or have them smashed.
Right.
What's the right approach to choosing which tools or platforms you use? We've got some managers getting quite excited about Twitter because everyone else is and wanting to do this because the Premier is, but we're tending to be a bit more cautious and saying, well, we need to look at what's going to help us achieve our objectives and what assets we have that we can leverage through that, or is that just being too overcomplicating it?
Well, I think one question is, where are your clients? All right. If your clients are using Twitter or Facebook or whatever it might be, then the decision in some sense is made. You can't force your clients to change what they do.
No. And as with any communication strategy, you know, there should be somewhere a cost-benefit analysis that you're doing internally. That, you know, just because something's popular, but if it doesn't reach people, it's going to cost you a lot. And so it is reasonable to say this is too expensive for us to do. And, you know, it's reasonable to say, and, you know, this is government money. We're not just going to waste it being fashionable. But you then still have to watch what's happening there to avoid somebody else doing it and you being exposed. So you need to be aware even if you're not participating.
You have no more questions? I do.
There's one here.
Thank you. I was just going to ask Mark and Bill, do you have any comments about the current flavour of the month in all the advertising agencies of harnessing social media for marketing purposes?
We both despair, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, anything can be used for corrupt purposes. Now, I think that the problem is that we are still making this up as we go along. And so anybody who comes to you and claims to be an expert, unless they can show you five great things they've done already, they're not an expert, and very few people can do that. And the chances are that your insights are going to be as good as the people who are offering to sell you insights for large amounts of money, because it is changing so quickly.
I think the other thing is that one of the big transitions that we're in is a transition from mass to demassified, whatever it is. And so the systems that have worked well with mass media don't really fit the mold. So the agencies are thinking always, they're always thinking about a mass mode, mass message, whereas as an individual or as a department, you actually might think, well, it's not so much that I need to reach everyone. What I need to do is reach the people who this matters to. And that's what social media is really good at. And you don't need an expert to tell you that.
Yeah, it's the unbearable lightness of Twitter.
I've got a cousin, and he's got a farm near Ballarat somewhere. He makes furniture, a little bit of wine, and pretty much hasn't got a computer. So How is all this really relevant to somebody who's not sort of connected?
But he has a mobile, right?
Well, a very old one. He just uses it to, you know, for business and stuff. You know, he doesn't know what Twitter is.
Yet. Yeah, well, even for people who have a mobile, I mean, SMS, particularly in the developing world, has been seen as an amazing portal to be able to get a wide range of services. And I think that's one of the things you need to think about when you're thinking about service delivery, is how do you deal with people who are really outside the loop? And we were talking about this yesterday during the libraries conference. You sort of have two different demographics, the underserved and the overserved. And actually, if you can figure out a strategy that works for both of them, you've covered it.
And yeah, it may be that, you know, that he doesn't need it, and he never will. And life will continue, and he will make his furniture, and people will buy it, and drink it, and that's fine. I think it's unlikely. And I think there will come the point at which there are things which he would like to do which can be facilitated by online media, and he decides they're attractive. So it's not about forcing anybody, but it is about keeping the option open for people to then take it on if they find it useful for them. One brief question more.
Is it brief?
We'll take two very quick questions, but make them quick. Make them now.
Quick. There's a taxi coming for me in 10 minutes.
Go.
I'll go ahead. I was just interested in your use of Twitter during crisis communications. Mm. That seems to be a real touch point when Twitter is reported upon in the media. Do you have any examples that come to mind about an excellent use of Twitter to avert a crisis or a
corporate
crisis?
No, that was brief.
Okay. Twitter is the world's most inane cocktail party until there's a disaster. And you could see this. The best example, I thought, was the original one, which was the Sichuan earthquake. All right. There was also the wildfires in California before that. But for the first 36 hours, the Chinese were getting better information off of Twitter than they were off of any of the mainstream media and were locating each other. So it's very good for that.
Yeah, no, I'm with that.
The importance of authenticity in social media communications.
Oh, God, yeah. That's a long one, too.
Yeah, how do you fake authenticity?
Yeah.
It's just such a problem.
Authenticity builds over time. That's the other side of it. One of the things that politicians in Australia have been dinged for is when they Twitter, but it's not really them Twittering. And, you know, they've been forced to fess up about that. And so you need to... honesty is a core part of authenticity. And I guess you have to start from honesty, and then the authenticity will build.
Yeah, and authenticity is not the same as validation. Just being sure that it is someone is not the same as that being their authentic voice. And that is something which comes, as Mark's saying, from empowerment, from giving people clear structures and saying, work within these structures and be good. You know, play nice, and people will find their voice, and then they'll be trusted.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.